Philadelphia, Philadelphia, are you ready? City of brotherly love, home of smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time, FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby, come on.
Christina Reyes with Jill Talk. Before I get started, I think it's important that the audience listening out there understand the reasoning behind Jill Talk. I've been saying for some time now we needed a platform, an outlet to have conversations related to what's taking place with the prison system, the effects that it has on all parties impacted by the system, such as those who are survivors of violence, individuals incarcerated, families, and communities. My goal is bringing more awareness to the side effects of prison and helping those who aren't aware to become educated, because this can happen to anyone. In today's discussion, we have a space for Richard Griffin, someone that I met during a Second Chance conference in Atlanta, which was held by FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and focused on bringing advocates together from across the state to discuss why we need to end mass incarceration. Richard Griffin, who is from Grand Rapids, Michigan, was a juvenile that received two life sentences and was released during the youth resentencing bill that passed with Miller versus Alabama, which deemed it unconstitutional to keep youth incarcerated under the age of 18. Richard served 23 years and was released in 2017. I first want to say welcome back, Richard, and you there, Richard?
I am, yes.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, one of the things that I want to know is, like, how does it feel being home after being incarcerated for 23 years?
That's a big question. First off, you know, I appreciate you inviting me on to your show and discussing these topics. I think, you know, not just here in Michigan or there in Pennsylvania, is this issue, you know, serious and important, but across the nation for people. But to your question, it feels surreal to some extent. There's moments when I believe, you know, I have to, you know, check myself to say, you know, you made it out of there. But I think for a lot of people who've served long indeterminate sentences in any correctional system, once they're released and there's some period of time between that release date and those experiences and their experience out here, I believe that we get acclimated to the liberties that we receive, and it gets better with, you know, every year, every day.
Definitely. One thing that I was thinking about the other day, because I was talking to someone who just got released from prison after serving 35 years in Pennsylvania, was like, what did that feeling feel like for you, just knowing that you were coming home when you had two life sentences, and I don't know how you felt during that time frame, if you were still fighting or if you were still getting educated, you know, for when you did come home, you'd be ready. But how did that feel like, knowing that you were coming home after being given two life sentences?
Yeah, so at 16, I was convicted and I was sentenced and sent to prison here in Michigan. And, you know, for the first, I never believed, like, in internally that I would die there, but all of my behavior, everything that, you know, my appellate efforts, my efforts to learn, you know, litigious information, litigating in criminal courts and appellate courts, all of those efforts spoke to me not wanting to die there, if that makes sense. So when I was released, and I just make mention of this, is noteworthy. As a juvenile, sentenced to those terms, the Miller v. Alabama ruling in 2012, which made it unconstitutional to sentence youth under the age of 18 to this unconstitutional sentence based on Eighth Amendment violation, was made retroactive in 2016. I was released in 2017, the latter part of it. And I probably didn't begin to really think that I would ever see the outside of a correctional institution until, I would say, maybe 2012. I think it took about, you know, 17 or 18 years before I could really see that there may be an opportunity for me to be released. And within, you know, 5 or 6 years, that was actualized. So, you know, wow. To your question, I never thought that I would get out until about 5 years before my release.
Wow. So for me, it's like, how old were you when you first got locked up?
The first time, like first arrest or first locked up on the crime that I was sentenced to life for.
Well, how long were you? When was the first time you got arrested?
Okay. I was first arrested at 12 for armed robbery. I probably had a couple of drug charges in between there, possession of narcotics, delivery of narcotics when I was 14, 15. And then I hit the lottery and was convicted of homicide and assault with intent to commit murder. And this assault and homicide was committed on two young black men in the community. And, you know, we all grew up in the drug environment, in the drug trade in the 90s. So this was the lifestyle for myself and the victims of my crime. But at 16, I was arrested and charged, convicted and sentenced prior to my 17th birthday. And then I received two life sentences, one for homicide, one for assault. And that was, you know, the end of it for me. I went to one of a couple of the worst prisons in Michigan, and you know, I was raised by the Department of Corrections.
Now, you said the first time that you were initially arrested was at 12, and that was for having narcotics. And then by 16, you were arrested and receiving the two life sentences. Now, how was it that you got wrapped up into a situation like that, being so young?
I was a street guy. I grew up, I started selling drugs at like 11 years old, started robbing people. You know, you're running the mill street guy on the corner selling drugs. What sent me to prison, the instance which sent me to prison, was a dispute over a bad drug deal or missing drugs. You know, there was a discrepancy in an exchange, and my way of resolving it at the time was, you know, to employ violence in the situation. So that's what led to my incarceration.
Wow. So what was your initial thought, like, being sentenced as a youth in that courtroom? Because I feel like you're so young. Did you really, like, realize what was taking place being in that courtroom, that you were being given so much time? Like, how was that emotion for you?
Oh, it's horrible. I remember years ago, I worked for the ACLU of Michigan. When I initially got released from prison, I was hired by the ACLU here to work on their Smart Justice campaign, which was an effort to, you know, have mass incarceration. However, at that time, you know, it was my involvement, I guess you could say, my involvement with on that type of work initially being released. Remind me of your question again. I think I lost it.
And so my question was, you know, being sentenced as a youth in the courtroom, because you're so young, and it's like did it hit you? Did it hit you later? Like, what was that emotion like?
Yeah. So my work in other spaces, that question has come up a lot, and this is why I mentioned prior work. But it felt like a cup of fire was poured down my throat. I felt like my body was on fire from the inside out. I thought that, you know, I would receive a different sentence. I thought that I would go to a juvenile facility. But because of my criminal history at the time, I mean, I wasn't just a kid that got in trouble with friends. Like, I had been living in the streets for several years. And at the time that I was, you know, arrested, I was living on my own. Paying bills on my own. You know, my lifestyle was a lot different from your average 16-year-old. So it wasn't a shock to me from a criminal standpoint. I knew that, you know, this would be the end result of something like this, or could potentially be the end result. So it was, you know, partly my pride made me just take it on the chin, if that makes sense. And the other side of me, I was devastated because I knew, you know, chances were I was going to die in prison.
Wow. So going into prison, and first and foremost, you're 16. So they didn't put you in a juvenile detention center.
No.
They put you in a prison with grownups, with adults. And you're like a young man, and now you're like in a room filled with other people. You know, that have been there for a while now. Like, how did that feel for you going into prison? Like, you know, and you got to watch your own back, but you've been doing that, you know, even prior to getting there.
Yeah. It's funny. It's strange. Nobody, if any guy or woman comes on this show or talks to you in your advocacy throughout the, you know, nation and tell you that they're not scared when they weren't scared when they went to prison, is probably not the truth. Nobody who has never been to prison is always going to be very alert or concerned about going into prison. You're right. There was no juvenile facility for me to go to, no like youth prison here in Michigan. So if you were a juvenile convicted of a crime as an adult here, if you're 14, 15, 16, you're going to the Department of Corrections, right? Typically, you're going to go to one or two facilities. If you have a long indeterminate sentence, 10 years or more than likely, you're going to go to the reformatory, the Michigan Reformatory, which is called Gladiator School here. Or you're going to go to MTU, which is like a training facility for folks to get graduated to the Gladiator School. But the Michigan Reformatory is the worst place you want to be. One of the oldest prisons in the nation. A wall prison where everybody there is the age of 14 to 24. And it's not like designed like that. They just wouldn't put people older than 24 at the facility because of manipulative reasons and influence, etc. But I mean, it was just, you know, everybody, all of your audience, your listeners right now, if they've been incarcerated in their own individual states, they know they probably have a prison that's just like that. And it's the worst place to be in the world.
Wow. So how were you able to like maintain relationships with like your family, with your friends? I mean, I'm just thinking about the fact that you're 16, so you must have been like in high school.
No, I hadn't been in school. I hadn't attended school for a few years. My freshman year of high school, I assaulted staff. And I was forbidden to, you know, enter any public schools in the city area. So I was no longer attending school by the time I was 15. But to your question, maintaining familial ties, relationships. I mean, at the time I had a girlfriend, but, you know, everybody knows, you know, in that situation, you got two life sentences. That's not going to last long. Mm-hmm. and my relationship with my family probably suffered a lot. You know, I didn't maintain good communication with family. And that was just because, you know, I was trying to survive prison, trying to figure a way to get out of there while they were living their lives out here. So it was difficult to maintain that. And then, you know, Michigan, while, you know, not that large, you know, prison system, just like in most states, all of the prisons are in upstate Michigan. So, you know, sometimes you're 7-8 hours away from your family. And they, like, a lot of people not driving over bridges and through blizzards to come visit somebody that's 8-9 hours away from them. You know what I mean? So it's difficult to maintain it. And I didn't do a great job at it because I was so focused on surviving.
Now, in surviving in prison, because we all know, I mean, anybody who's been to prison or has a loved one that's in prison, it is so hard to get education opportunities and, you know, let alone a good paying job. We have inflation going on and people are not getting top dollars when they're running the prison. I always say that people that are incarcerated are running the prison, but they are not given the opportunities or the wages necessary to live in that prison. Right. The other thing is these men and women are being warehoused. So, like, how is it, because you're so articulate, how are you able to get that education?
Part of that is just whether or not you want that, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? Think about this. You go to prison, you're 16 years old. You're in a maximum security facility. You're getting out for 1 hour and 15 minutes a day total. You have nothing to do but think, time to, you know, ingratiate yourself in something that is productive in some capacity, right? But about 2014, I think, Michigan allowed for academic institutions to come in and create a lane for currently incarcerated persons to attend college classes, where they sent adjunct professors from, let's say, like 5 different collegiate institutions to come in and create this college program. So I got involved with that pretty early. The University of Michigan, Michigan State, a couple of other, you know, institutions over there where I was able to attend college for a few years prior to my release. But the bulk of it comes from just wanting to better yourself generally. You know what I mean? You don't have nothing but time to invest in you. So if you can recognize, you know, some of the errors in your ways throughout the course of your life and start to make those corrections, you just kind of give yourself, you put yourself in a position to enrich you before, you know, you can make a complaint that you're in this situation. You got to make the best of it. Why not enrich yourself while you're here? You know what I mean? But that's not everybody's, you know, bag, so to speak. So some men and women, I'm certain, go into prison and they get settled in a way, and they just go with the norm of things, and they don't, you know, invest in themselves mentally, emotionally, psychologically, or academically. But that was, you know, my education, you know, early on in school, I was an astute student until the streets got a hold to me. And then, you know, while incarcerated, I educated myself large in part for the first 14 or 15 years, and then attended college the last, you know, 6 or 7 years that I was inside.
Can I just ask, like, because people really don't understand, they don't know this, but how long does it take to get a degree while you're incarcerated?
It could take years. You know, sometimes, like, these classes are being paid for out of pocket. So let's say somebody who doesn't have a family member that can help them with those costs, then they're, you know, trying to save up money from their state job to pay for college courses that, you know, are the same rate for people incarcerated as they are for folks in society. And those courses can run from, you know, $800 to $1,100 a class. So if guys, men and women, didn't have family members helping pay for that, you know, they wouldn't be able to enjoy it, to experience those things. You know, that was just a wonky process where, you know, if you had the money available, then you'd be able to participate in it.
Now, Richard, one thing that I'm thinking about, and, you know, I've spoken to a lot of different individuals, is you know, what do you think people should know about the lifers that are in prison that are going to be there for a long amount of time if we don't try to work towards changing these bills?
Yeah.
What do you want people to know about those individuals? Because I feel like people at times, they think that because a person's in prison, like, they're looking at them being the worst of the worst, or sometimes they're just forgotten. What do you want them to know about some of the people that you know that you've been in prison with?
Those are some of the brightest people in the world, some of the most creative people in the world. You know, in my day-to-day life and career, I work as a lobbyist or a political organizer. I'm currently working on second look legislation in Michigan with the Sentencing Project and a large coalition of Michigan organizations that are working to get this particular policy passed that will be a valve to allow folks who've served longer than 10 years to appeal to their sentencing judges for a resentence based on, you know, all of the mitigating factors and variables in their crime, as well as their institutional records. But in that space, you know, I talk to lawmakers regularly, and that question comes up a lot. You know, the people in our society who live pro-social lives, right? Your professionals, your lawmakers, your judges, your prosecutors. Most of these folks were one decision away from being in that position themselves. And the men and women who you see coming home from prison were one good decision away from being in those positions. I think that often when we judge persons who have been incarcerated, we fail to take into account how they got there. And poverty is at the core of criminality in this nation. We don't incarcerate criminals. We criminalize poverty. And when you criminalize poverty, you put somebody in a position because they're not capable or able in those moments. But we have systems in society that perpetuate those systems, which places those folks in these positions. Now, I'm gonna be the first to say I've seen men in prison who I probably wouldn't want living next door to me. Those are my personal, you know, opinions and positions. But most of the folks that exist in Michigan's Department of Corrections, there's 36,000 people incarcerated here. A few years ago, we had about 10 years ago, we had just about 55,000 or so. So we've chopped into the prison population with policies that have been passed over the last 5 to 10 years. But many of those folks out of that 36,000, there's about 21,000 of them who suffer from mental health disorders. Right.
Yeah.
But then you have a large portion of those persons who probably have aged out of incarceration. There's only 1% of that population, let's say 350 people, who will never be released, right? The 350 out of 36,000. So the remaining 35,400 folks, at some point, they're going to be your podcast host. They're going to be your Uber driver. They're going to be your Grubhub, your DoorDash person. They're going to bag your groceries at the grocery store. They're going to be helping you in retail. You're going to walk by them while they're walking a dog in the park. You're going to see them at the gym working out. Like these are people that are in your society now. Right. So if you're not accept, we can't accept them for where they are because of decisions that they made based on systems that they live under, you know, based on a society that they live in. Then we're doing ourselves a disservice because most of those folks in there are very creative, very bright, highly intelligent people who have been in positions to make decisions out of duress, which our society has criminalized over the duration of our history here.
That kind of leads me into my next question. I remember that when we went to the conference and we were in Atlanta, you know, I remember when we initially first met, It was Daniel Jones who had brought me down, and we were in the area of the hotel and just kind of having a conversation because he was another youth that had came home as well. Yeah. And in our conversation, he was talking about the work that he was doing with his advocacy, talking to other people about, you know, the reentry of incarceration and how, you know, people, they don't recidivize, especially when they've been spending decades in prison. But, you know, this man was doing some wonderful work, the same as you. And I remember that when we came back after leaving the conference, he was killed. And it kind of goes into my next question, because, you know, Daniel was killed, and then probably about, I would say, like 3 weeks going into four, I had a really good friend that's also, he was an advocate, and he was a youth that came home named Tyree Little. And during the burial of his funeral, someone else was killed, and his name was Christopher Williams, who got exonerated. Mm-hmm. And it kind of leads me to making a question of, like, do you feel safe, you know, when you do come home? Because, I mean, it doesn't feel safe in prison, because, as you stated, some of these people wouldn't be people that you would want necessary to live next door. But right. If you knew a person was working on themselves, and, you know, people age out of doing anything, right. You know, because when you're younger, like they were stating, you're more impulsive. And I don't know why they're not doing the neurological, they're not doing that study a little bit more, right. Which that would help people maybe between the age of 18 to 24 come home. But, like, have you experienced moments where you feel like you have to be very security minded being out here in these streets, because you have to be aware?
Oh, ain't no question about it. You mentioned Daniel, and Danny is, you know, was a good friend of mine, man. And he was a juvenile lifer, came in at 16 years old. He served 19 years, was released because of Miller v. Alabama. And he got involved in, you know, the Michigan advocacy field. In Michigan, formerly incarcerated people have a large showing, you know, so to speak. There's a lot of folks that have come home and gotten his work. But Danny was one who, you know, he was a standout amongst most of us, right? There's a lot of, he stood out, very articulate, you know, well presented, handsome dude. You know what I mean? A lot of people love Danny. And unfortunately, when we returned from that Atlanta trip, when we met you, Daniel drove home from the airport to Detroit. I drove home to Grand Rapids, and I woke up to a call saying he had been killed. And we, you know, still don't know what happened. We think that it was a carjacking, but many men that I know from prison have come home and met their demise at gun violence. And a lot of that speaks to the life that they lived prior to, you know, like when we come from the streets, you know, you really can't. And I'll just say it how the people understand it. You can't forgive a body. You know, you can't mm-hmm. You can't excuse that. So some people who still live in that frame of mind, just because you've changed and you have a different direction in life, it doesn't mean that other people don't still feel a particular way about what you did to them or their loved one. So sometimes it's difficult to even take into consideration that you shouldn't be safe. You know what I mean? Even in this advocacy world, I work in spaces where I got to go into communities and talk to community members and stakeholders, and often I've run into family members of my victim. You know, I was doing an event for a very prestigious Black organization nationally. And I showed up to the event, and there were, you know, a contingent of the victim's family present. And, you know, I guess their intention was to confront me about it. But because of the environment and what was going on, it was thwarted. And I ended up having a conversation with these folks on that night. But to that point, sometimes we have to be extremely mindful. Just because we've changed our life or we feel a different way, it doesn't mean that, you know, the folks who were victims of ours feel a different way about what we've done.
You know, I wanted to kind of say something, because the other day I went to this event, and it was for the youth that were resentenced. And, you know, I'm a major advocate for second chances, but being in that space, I was almost like forgetful as well, because I had been impacted, and someone that was part of the youth that were resentenced came home, and you know, it kind of made me feel like, okay, I'm in this space and we're welcoming back people who are doing productive things. But then at the same time, you know, you still have people that are victims, and, you know, not everyone's going to feel the same way about it because they still lost a person.
That's right. Right. And that's my point in a nutshell, is that we can never regulate or manage another person's emotions about things that we've done to them that were considered wrong. So, like, you know, I try to stay out of my old neighborhood as much as possible. But I mean, I'm still there. I'm there as consistent as I have been in the past. And primarily is because of work. But I'm very mindful of where I go, who I'm around. Some of the jobs that I take, have to be mindful of if I'm driving my own vehicle or if I, you know, get a rental to go to this event, just based on the fact that people may know who it is, you know. So that living walk with your head on a swivel after prison is real.
No, it definitely is. Now, my question for you, because I remember when we were having our conversations and, you know, I was talking to Daniel about his life and he was telling me all the great work that he was doing with his advocacy, and you were sitting next to me having a whole conversation with Alexandra. You know, we were talking about maintaining that sanity. Like, how did you maintain that sanity being in prison? Because as you stated, a lot of people are suffering from mental health, but yeah, there's also people that are also kind of they're adding to mental health that people have while they're in prison, you know, by placing them in the hole.
Yeah. It's tough to maintain sanity in there. And I'll say this, you know, a lot of young kids that go to prison, they pay judges a lot of money for their discretion and their discernment. Right. And I don't think that they get it right probably 30% of the time. But a judge knows when somebody is not going to change their life. Like, I'm convinced of that. Like, in my wisdom, I can see young men who I've made that determination to say, hey, bro, you got another prison bit of you. You'll be back. I can see it in you, right? In their wisdom, judges make that decision. And, you know, often you never know your own fortitude or resilience. And the only thing I can attribute it to, speaking for myself, is my resilience, my fortitude, my ability to be built in a way that I can take, you know, tough issues. And I was able to deal with it in a way that seemingly kept my sanity intact while still being able to evolve as a human, as a man, as a father. You know what I mean? But I don't know, you know, that I think that's all relative to the individual, whether or not they can cope with, you know, the pressures of prison, especially like segregation. It's the most isolating thing that you can ever experience as a human. You're technically in a mop closet of concrete, you know, 24 hours a day, sometimes upwards of 10 years at a time. I've served in total, you know, a couple of years in segregation. But it's nowhere that an individual wants to be trying. It's not an environment that you want to try to foster yourself in.
Now, being in Michigan, how are the prisons over there? Like, how are the environments? Because I know everybody says that the environments of prison are like terrible. You know, yeah, you have places where the water is coming out and it's next to coal mines and it's dirty and,
yeah.
You know, this is what you're bathing in or drinking, but you're also dealing with racism being in these prisons and dealing with staff that have a lot of hatred for people who are incarcerated.
Word. So indeed, that happens for real. I've been in prison where, you know, officers called me a nigger to my face.
Wow.
I've been in prisons where, you know, during count time, officers will come by and count you as a monkey or a wetback. That's the way, or a stick, depending upon your nationality. They just, you know, they'll get over the intercom and say, we got 57 niggers on the rock and 23 spicks and 19 wetbacks, and it's, you know, lovely white guys on the other side are numbering at 19. You guys have a good night. You know, and that's just that kind of foolishness. But most of the prisons in Michigan are in northern Michigan, right? You have some in the lower half of the state, but most of them are in the upper peninsula, northern Michigan. And, you know, this is militia town over here. Michigan's militia is pretty prevalent. It's pretty strong. So you get a lot of those folks who become correctional officers. And then you got, you know, in Michigan, when I went to prison at 16, coming in, if you weren't like just standing on your own 2 feet, you do your own thing. You were part of a religious group. There were, may have been two or three gangs that had a good presence, a good showing, but not really, right? It was more okay. So you're either a Muslim, you're either Sunni Muslim or Shia Muslim, you're in the Nation of Islam, Moorish American, or some other kind of revolutionary or religious organization, 5%, you know, you're something. Or you just traveling by yourself, and that's cool too. But, you know, a lot of people choose to find God in those situations. And sometimes, you know, people get involved with that. Those environments, those realities were dangerous too, because, you know, it's prison. And religious groups operating in a prison setting, you know, have to abide by prison laws before they abide by God's law.
Wow. I think that's in a lot of prisons that I've heard about as well. So such a loyalty, a respect that has to take place in those settings.
No doubt. And if you get outside of the bounds of that, like, your God can't help you, you know, not there.
Wow. So how has your transition been since coming home? And, you know, I know that you're doing work and you're doing your advocacy. I know that you're doing that statewide, and you're sharing like your personal experiences with a lot of people besides trying to change the system, because, you know, I think people fail to know that when we talk about mass incarceration, it's also population. I mean, there's a culture of people that are in these prisons, but it's a race of people that are also there as well. Blacks being the top. And then after that, you got brown folks, and then you have everyone else.
Right.
So being in the place, you're just seeing, you know, people that look like you as well.
Right. My transition, I'm going to say it was seamless. I'm going to tell you a quick anecdote. When you leave Michigan prison, you go to the facility that's regional to the area you're going home to. So because I was coming back to Grand Rapids, I paroled from a facility in Middle Michigan, in Ionia, where the Michigan Reformatory or Gladiator School is. Coming home, there was maybe four or five guys that was getting released that same week. And I ran into one of the guys. I was going to have breakfast like by fifth. That was home maybe a week. And I'm going to have breakfast. I walk into the restaurant, see this kid. He got on the state clothes. He got on state jacket. He got on the biscuit shoes. You know what I mean? And he looking for a job, but he still got his prison uniform on. And I'm like, yo, I just was on the rock with you, right? He's like, yeah, you know, what's going on? He's like, damn, what you got going on out here? So I say,
hold on, he left with the prison uniform, or is that all that he had?
That's all that he had.
Because I could only imagine if he was a kid when he went in there. I mean, them clothes ain't going to fit him.
Well, no, not those same ones, but they give you something to wear as you parole out, right? They give you a new khaki uniform, khaki jacket, and the Bob Barker biscuit shoes, and you know, going about your business, right? So he got this uniform on, and I'm like, damn, when you come home? He like, 3 days ago. I'm saying, damn, you still in them same kicks, bro? You still got on the prison outfit? And he looking at me like, what you got going? You just came home like 5-6 days ago. You look like you've been out here for 10 years. Well, I came home. My father gave me two cars. And I'll say this, whether it matters or not, we're talking about criminal justice reform, but I'm going to speak to street stuff. My relationship and my integrity in my neighborhood is impeccable. I didn't have any, I didn't have no bullshit on my name coming home. So people looked out for me. You know what I mean? People showed up. and made sure that I was straight coming home. And I didn't get a job for 4 months because, you know, the money that I received from people coming home, all of the things that people gave me, I was okay. But shortly after I got out, I started to do some minor lobbying work for a university that I was connected to while inside. That lobbying project, which lasted maybe 2 months, led me to the attention of the ACLU of Michigan. And I interviewed and hired and for a position for the Smart Justice Campaign with them. I stayed there in that role for maybe 2.5 years. And I left and went and created my own consulting company. So I created a government relations firm that had, you know, young students, interns, and formerly incarcerated folks working towards creating a new nonprofit to work on social justice issues. I still do that work. I currently am employed by American Friends Service Committee, which is headquartered in Philadelphia, but we have offices over here in Michigan. And I work on a prison project where I'm like lead, a policy analyst for the Second Look stuff over here. But I mean, I work in different capacities. I work with Cure Violence here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I hold some positions, some contract positions with the city of Grand Rapids. To be honest with you, the transition into the work was easy. The transition from prison to this was easy, but the toughest transition was emotional. Okay. The emotional transition is tough.
Tell me what that looks like.
Well, you by yourself all day, every day, right? You in the penitentiary with guys all day. So there's no real emotional exchanging or emotional outlets, no venting, right? Venting is like you coming at the end of a knife or a fist. So you don't really have those opportunities to do that in that capacity. So you don't build real relationships with people. You know, they're packaged. A relationship is in a box. It has to be a particular way while you're locked up. It just has to. So when you come home, you know, for me as a man, like getting involved with women, learning people, learning women, you know what I'm saying? Trying to learn a new person in your life is difficult because you got so many guards up. You got so much trauma from the way that you've had to conduct yourself over the last however long you were incarcerated. So now you're in a position where you got to be vulnerable. You got to tell your girlfriend, right, your partner, how you feel, what you're thinking, how you know, what you think about a thing, how you want to approach this. And you're not used to that. You ain't used to telling nobody how you feel, what you think, what was, you know, the best strategy. Do you think that was a good decision? You just make them on your own and you go because you don't have nobody else to be concerned about. So the transition is like consideration of other folks. And that's tough for some people that come out of jail.
Wow. So like, do you still connect with people that are incarcerated? Because sometimes I feel like, and I've noticed this too. Sometimes men and women incarcerated feel like their friends left them, like their comrades behind in their transition of coming home.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I got
a lot. Is there anybody you're connected with?
Yeah, definitely. This morning I talked to a guy, a real good friend of mine who comes home in about 18 days.
Was he another youth?
He came in at 19, so he wasn't sentenced and convicted as a juvenile or as an adult, but he did go to prison before he was 20, so still a young guy. He served 24 years now. Yeah, so he's been incarcerated for 24, 25 years. He's about to come home in 3 weeks. Real good friend of mine. I talked to him this morning for about an hour. He calls me once a week. We talk for about an hour every time he calls. And then I have, you know, a handful of friends that are still locked up that I met while in prison. I became friends with there. And, you know, they call periodically when they need money. But, you know, that happens. That's real. They don't call to check on you as much, but, you know, all the same. And that's the reality is, I think for a lot of us, we come home with survivor's guilt. You know what I mean? That you survived it and your buddy didn't. That's tough to eat.
I think, too, that it's a hard transition coming back into society. And, you know, sometimes there's not a good there's not good resources out there, especially, let's say, for instance, in your situation, you came home after so many years being away from society, from your family. You know, you're dealing with things emotionally, as you stated. And I also feel like there should be more resources that are provided for individuals that are coming home. Definitely. So that they can thrive.
Definitely, definitely. Those things are almost non-existent here in Michigan. I know that other states have a lot of, you know, have some robust reentry programs going on. But Michigan, we kind of, you know, we're behind the eight ball on that one. We don't do well with how we resource or how we, the inroads to resources that we provide for people who've experienced incarceration. It's just we do a piss poor job at it at best.
I was curious to know how many youth came home during the youth resentencing in Michigan that you're aware of.
I want to say upwards of like 50 to date, but you know, there's so many of them who have yet to be resentenced still. Or if they did get resentenced, they got sentenced to an absurd amount of numbers, right? 40 years, 55 years, and they only had, you know, 25, 30 in. So they're still looking at these long, indeterminate, ridiculous sentences that are unnecessary. But if I had to guess a number, I mean, probably more than 50, but not too much more. But I mean, at the time, Michigan has the most juvenile lifers incarcerated. At one point, you guys had it. Pennsylvania had the highest number. Now it's Michigan, and we hold that nasty title.
Now, you said 50 people came home during the youth resentencing, right? How many people? Yeah. To date, but then what they were given were they were resentenced to harsher sentences because they still got like 15 more years, if not 20, to come home. So by the time they come home, it's like they're starting all over again. And I mean, these individuals can range from anywhere between their 50s, 60s, 70s, right? Yeah. Are you guys working on any bills in Michigan besides the second chance look that you mentioned?
Well, second chance, second look is out there, and that's it being introduced like as we speak. There's a bill right now to eliminate juvenile life without parole as a potential sentence for judges. So we're trying to push this legislative session for the legislature to do away with that sentence altogether so that it's no longer available. Also, there's some efforts for like fair chance housing. There's a lot of local municipal initiatives across the state to enact some fair chance housing ordinances. There's a big push in some cities as like sanctuary cities that don't, you know, ask about felony background or applications for housing, employment, education. Clean slate the policy that was passed. We're looking to kind of figure out all of the nuances of how we get folks' records expunged. But that was passed recently. Michigan passed raised the age, so you no longer are considered a juvenile at the age of 17, or excuse me, no longer considered an adult at the age of 17. You have to be 18 to be processed through an adult court. So we've had some small wins. There's also a big push for bail reform here. You know, pretrial jail conditions are pretty horrid for men and women experiencing that incarceration. And bail has been one of the linchpins or off ramps, if you will, to longer or more packed institutions, if you will.
Exactly. The other thing is, coming from these low economical communities, people sometimes don't realize there's no money to pay for a lawyer. Really help out in your situation.
Yeah, I was just telling a group of car kids the other day, these young guys pull up on me in gas station, and like they got two Dracos in the car and, you know, another firearm. And I asked all the guys in the car how much money they had together. And I think they had about $100 between the four of them. I said, man, the guns that you guys got cost more than the amount of money y'all got in your pocket. How do you even come across this and why you in this position. You riding around with firearms and you don't got no money, man. Don't nobody want to do nothing to you. You broke. Right? But we can't, you can't tell these kids that. You know what I mean? Exactly. You can't tell them that you don't got the money to pay a lawyer to fight a homicide case, man. That, you know, that's going to run you every bit of $20,000-$25,000 just at base. So, like, these kids don't really get what they're involved with out here. I didn't understand it, but I think that I was in a position where I didn't care. You know what I mean? Anybody in your listening audience who grew up in the latter part of the 80s, the early 90s in the drug trade knows that, you know, our morale, black men, brown men, our morale during those decades was very low.
I love that you mentioned that, because I feel like besides you said it out loud, but it's also about the fact that, you know, we need more mentors. So like, what would you tell a kid at your age, you know, going into the system, you know, about your experience?
Well, I mean, I would just share my experience, but I'm going to be honest with you. I approach those situations just like deaths. When somebody dies, somebody close to me has a family member that passes away, I can't tell them nothing. I don't know what to tell them. Nothing I can say going to make you feel better. And nothing I can tell you is going to prepare you for prison, because your experience is going to be determined by who you are. Your experience in prison is going to be determined by who you are. You can't be me. You can't be anybody other than yourself. So whatever that is, that's going to determine what your time there like. And, you know, the best thing I can tell a guy is to mind his own business. He may live longer.
You're right about that.
When they go to prison, they've graduated, Christina. Like, they yeah. Reached the big leagues. You know what I mean?
You're right about that. And a lot of men I know and women have gone to prison. You know, they say that prison may have taught them a lesson that they weren't receiving out here in these streets. And, you know, how do you feel about that, going to prison at such a young age? Like, did you feel like it saved you? Did it teach you? Did somebody in prison, you know, give you some type of advice, you know, going in and being such a young man?
I always characterize it like this. My father was present in my home my whole life. He's still alive, still in my life. But he, my father was a functioning illiterate, so he didn't know what to tell me. He didn't know how to tell me anything. I was the father in that relationship. Now, I went to prison as a kid who was masquerading as a man. I was pretending to be a man. I didn't know what that was. And in doing so, getting to prison, you can't call your father, your mother and say, hey, how do I deal with this guy who I think is going to try to fight me? Or how do I deal with this correction officer that's, you know, fucking with me every day? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not calling home, getting no advice from your mother, your father no more. You either going to become a man or somebody else and they're going to raise you. Right. So I had to become a man overnight in order to raise the kid that I still was. So I attribute most of who I am to myself and me raising that person. But of course, everybody come across, you know, the jailhouse peasant that got good wisdom for you or somebody who can direct your attention to a thing here or there. But I don't give credit to anybody other than myself. I mean, I went in there by myself. I was the only person on the ID and I was the only person that they scrolled out of there.
You're right about that. And I like to commend you on that, because you are an exceptional man that's doing remarkable things. And you know, this kind of comes into the next thing. It's called Jail Call, right, Richard? Yeah. And, you know, you and me kind of spoke about this, but you know what a jail call is. A jail call is 15 minutes where you get to talk to your loved one in prison. And anybody who had a jail call before, it's like you got to compile everything into that 15 minutes, whether it's good, bad, indifferent, whether you're trying to tell a joke up until the last second. But with the jail call on Jail Talk, it's a 15-minute call of action where I want to bring awareness to our audience, and I want to educate them in areas related to what's taking place in the prison system, or just, you know, having them take 15 minutes out of their day to just learn about what is going on out here in the world. So, you know, I want you to give the 15 minute call of action today and let the audience know what you want them to learn and what you want them to know.
True indeed. So I appreciate that too. Thank you for those compliments. It, no matter where you are, what state you live in, what city you live in, like, you know, get activated, find out who's doing what, where. In Michigan, you know, we have a few pieces of policy in a very large advocacy field in the state of Michigan. So I don't know what the advocacy world looks like in other places where your listeners are at, but you know, wherever there's some, you know, the one way that you need to be involved is to, you know, elevate your political efficacy. We get in these spaces of poverty, these spaces of criminal justice reform, the criminal legal system, and all of the things that, you know, are in that wheelhouse because we're not informed and we don't have decision making power. So I would encourage folks to get involved in your municipal government, get involved in local government, go to your city council, your city commission meetings, go to your county commission meetings, listen to the appropriations budget, hear where they're allocating funds at, hear what kind of programs and projects are out there, right? And begin to advocate for yourself, especially for mothers of black and brown men. Go to those school board meetings. Sit in on those school board meetings. Take notes. Take minutes. You know, form a committee of parents who, you know, hold the school board accountable. Because, you know, we talk about prison to school pipeline, or the school to prison pipeline, but you know, that's a reality. You know, these are institutions that are setting our children up for day rooms, setting our children up for the yard. They're setting our children up, you know, for those realities. So I encourage all mothers of black and brown men to be at every school board conversation that they can be at. Get involved in local government, then get involved as an advocate or an activist about what you're passionate about. Let your voice be heard and don't allow anybody to close it. But any particular call to action, there's national policy for a second look, not only in D.C., Virginia, New York, in Michigan, Nebraska, I believe, you know, get involved with these policy pushes that are national or local to your particular state. And you know, if you have somebody who is incarcerated, a loved one, a partner, a friend, you know, take some time to understand the things that they go through. Listen to them. That my biggest call to action is be present for the people that you love. You never know when they may not be here.
You're right about that. And I want to just say thank you so much for being on our show today. And I want to give a special shout out to Daniel Jones, who was a major advocate. I want to give a shout out to Tyree Little, Christopher Williams. Although they're not here with us, they are definitely not forgotten. And I want to give a shout out to Rolo. Next up, we have Suave Gonzalez and Kevin McCracken with DBI Live coming on next. And again, Jail Talk is every Friday at 4 p.m., so tune back in.
Don't be the sucker. Olympics in Johannesburg.